Since when?
Yesterday.
Where does he live now?
No idea.
Didn't he leave his new address?
No.
And the porter looked up and recognized Marius.
Well, it's you, he said. So you really are a snitch, then.
Book 7. Patron Minette. Mines and Miners. Every human society has what is known in the theatre as the third substage, the lowest level below stage. The social soil is everywhere mined, for better or for worse. This honeycomb of underground tunnels is layered. There are the upper mines and the lower mines. There is a top and a bottom in this dark basement that sometimes caves in under civilization, and which we, in our careless indifference, stomp around on and trample underfoot. The encyclopedia in the last century was virtually an open-cut mine. The darkness, that murky incubator of primitive Christianity, was just waiting for the chance to set off an explosion under the Caesars and flood the human race with light. For in the thickest darkness there is latent light. Volcanoes are full of darkness capable of bursting into flame. All lava begins in blackness. The catacombs, where the first mass was said, were not only the caves of Rome, they were the underground of the world. Underneath the social structure, that marvel saddled with a ramshackle slum, all kinds of shafts have been bored. There is the religious mine, the philosophical mine, the political mine, the economic mine, the revolutionary mine. One person digs with an idea, another digs with numbers, yet another digs with rage. There is calling and answering from one catacomb to the next. Utopias make their way underground in tunnels that branch out in every direction. They sometimes run into each other there and fraternize. Jean-Jacques lends his pick to Diogenes, who lends him his lantern. Sometimes they do battle. Calvin grabs Socine by the hair. But nothing stops or interrupts the straining of all these energies toward their goal. And this vast simultaneous activity comes and goes, goes up and down and up again in the darkness, slowly transforming what lies above from below and the outside from the inside in an immense teeming infestation. Society barely suspects this burrowing and undermining that changes its very guts, leaving its surface untouched. So many subterranean levels, so many different works, so many diverse yields. What comes out of all this deep delving? The future. The deeper down you go, the more mysterious the workers become. Down to a level that social philosophy is still able to recognize, the work is good. Beyond this level, it is dubious and mixed. Deeper still, it becomes appalling. At a certain depth, the excavation work becomes impenetrable to the spirit of civilization. The limit at which mankind can breathe is exceeded. It is here that monsters may crop up. The ladder going down is strange, and each of its rungs corresponds to a level where philosophy can get a foothold and where you meet one of the workers, sometimes divine, sometimes deformed. Below John Huss is Luther. Below Luther is Descartes. Below Descartes is Voltaire. Below Voltaire is Condorcet. Below Condorcet is Robespierre. Below Robespierre is Marat. Below Marat is Babeuf. And on it goes. Lower still, murkily, at the line that divides the indistinct from the invisible, you catch sight of other somber men who perhaps do not yet exist. Those of yesterday are ghosts. Those of tomorrow are spectral larvae. The mind's eye dimly makes them out. The embryonic labor of the future is one of the visions of the philosopher. A limbo world and fetal state, something never before seen. Saint-Simon, Owen, and Fourier are there too, inside saps. Of course, although unbeknownst to them, an invisible divine chain connects all these pioneers of the underground, who almost always believe themselves to be alone, but are not. Their work is extremely varied, and the light of some contrasts with the blazing of others. Some are heavenly, others tragic. Yet whatever the contrast, all these workers, from the uppermost to the most nocturnal, from the wisest to the most unhinged, have one thing in common, and it is this: disinterestedness. Marat, like Jesus, forgets about himself. They put themselves completely to one side, leave themselves out, do not think about themselves. They see something other than themselves. They have a look in their eyes, and this look is trained on the absolute. The very uppermost among them has the whole sky in his eyes. The lowest, no matter how enigmatic he may be, still has the pale glow of infinity in his sights. So no matter what he does, venerate whoever bears the sign of starry eyes. Dead eyes, that is the opposite sign. Evil starts with dead eyes. Faced with someone whose eyes see nothing, think carefully and be afraid. The social order has its starless miners. There is a point where digging any deeper means being entombed and where the light is completely extinguished. Below all these mines that we have described, below all these galleries, below all this vast network of the underground veins of progress and utopia, far deeper in the earth, deeper than Marat, deeper than Babeuf, deeper, far deeper, way beyond any connection to the upper levels, there is the final sap, a dreadful place. This is what we have called the third substage, the dregs, rock bottom. It is the pit of darkness. It is the repository of the blind. Inferi. This is the way to the bottomless abyss. The dregs. Here, disinterestedness vanishes. The fiend dimly takes shape. It is every man for himself. The eyeless self howls, hunts, gropes, and gnaws. Society's cannibals, the Ugolinos, are found in this abyss. The savage figures that prowl around this pit, half beast, half phantom, do not bother themselves with universal progress. They have never heard of the idea or the word. All they care about is individual satisfaction. They are barely conscious, and inside them, there's a sort of terrifying blankness. They have two mothers, both stepmothers, ignorance and misery. They have one guide only, want, and only one craving for all forms of gratification. They are brutally voracious, that is, ferocious, not in the manner of the tyrant, but in the manner of the tiger. These ghouls start out as larvae in dire poverty and then move on to crime. A fatal line of descent, a dizzying begetting, the logic of the dark. What grovels in this third social substage is no longer the stifled demand for the absolute. It is the protest of matter. Man turns into dragon there. Going hungry or thirsty is the point of departure. Turning into Satan is the point of arrival. From this underground repository, Lacenaire emerges. A moment ago in Book 4, we saw one of the chambers of the upper mine, of the great sap of politics, revolution, and philosophy. There, as we said, all is noble, pure, dignified, honest. Of course, you can make mistakes there, and do make mistakes, but error is venerable there, for it involves so much heroism. The whole of the work done there has a name: progress. The time has come to take a peek at depths below this, hideous depths. Underneath society there is, and we must insist, until the day ignorance is dispelled, there always will be, the great cavern of evil. This repository is below all the rest, and is the enemy of all the rest. It is hate without exception. This cavernous hold knows no philosophers, its daggers have never whittled quills. Its blackness bears no relation to the sublime sable blackness of the writing case. Never have the fingers of night, that clenched beneath that suffocating ceiling, leafed through a book or unfolded a newspaper. Babeuf is an exploiter for Cartouche. Marat is an aristocrat for Schinderhannes. The aim of this dark hold is to bring everything crashing down. Everything, including the upper galleries, which it loathes. In its hideous pullulation, it not only undermines the current social order, it undermines philosophy. It undermines science. It undermines law. It undermines human thought. It undermines civilization. It undermines revolution. It undermines progress. It is called, quite simply, theft, prostitution, murder, and assassination. It is darkness, and it desires chaos. Its vaulted roof is made of ignorance. All the others, those above, have but one goal, and that is to do away with it. It is to this end that philosophy and progress tend, through all their organs at once, through the improvement of the real as well as contemplation of the absolute. Destroy the dark hold, ignorance, and you destroy the mole, crime. To sum up in a few words part of what we have just said, the sole social peril is darkness. Humanity is identity. All men are made of the same clay, no difference, here below at least, in predestination. The same darkness before, the same flesh during, the same ashes after. But when ignorance is mixed with human dough, it blackens it. This incurable blackness takes over man's insides, and there turns into evil. Babet, Gueulemer, Claquesous, and Montparnasse. A quartet of crooks, Claquesous, Gueulemer, Babet, and Montparnasse, ruled the dregs of Paris from 1830 to 1835. Gueulemer was a low-life Hercules. His hideout was the Arche Marion Sewer. He was 6 feet tall, had pectorals of marble, biceps of bronze, cavernous lungs, the torso of a colossus, and the skull of a bird. You would think you were looking at the Farnese Hercules, decked out in drilled trousers and a velveteen jacket. Built along such sculptural lines, Gueulemer could have broken monsters. He had found it easier to become one. With a low forehead, broad temples, a mass of crow's feet, though not yet 40 years old, wiry short hair, bushy cheeks, the beard of a wild boar, you can see the man from here. His muscles cried out for work. His stupidity wouldn't hear of it. He was a huge, lazy force. He was a killer out of nonchalance. He was thought to be a Creole. He had probably had a bit of a brush with Maréchal Brune at one time, having done a stint as a porter in Avignon in 1815. After that lesson, he moved up in the world and graduated as a crook. Babet's diaphanousness was in stark contrast to Gueulemer's meatiness. Babet was skinny and smart. He was transparent yet impenetrable. You could see daylight through his bones, but nothing in his eyes. He claimed to be a chemist. He had been a buffoon at Bobèche's and a clown at Bobineau's. He had played vaudeville at Saint-Mihiel. He was a man full of hot air, a good talker who put his smiles in italics and his gestures in inverted commas. His business was selling plaster busts and portraits of the head of state out on the street. On top of this, he pulled teeth. He had shown freaks at fairs and owned a booth with a trumpet and this advertisement. Babet, dental artist, member of the academies, conducts physical experiments on metals and metalloids, extracts teeth, tackles stumps abandoned by his colleagues. Price, 1 tooth, 1 franc 50 centimes, 2 teeth, 2 francs, 3 teeth, 2 francs 50 centimes. Take advantage of this opportunity. That take advantage of this opportunity meant get as many pulled out as possible. He'd been married, and he had had children. He did not know what had become of his wife or his children. He had lost them the way you lose your hanky. A noteworthy exception in the obscure world he lived in, Babet read the newspapers. Once, in the days when he had his family traveling with him in his booth on wheels, he had read in the Messager that a woman had given birth to a child with the muzzle of a calf who was likely to survive, and he had cried, "That's worth a fortune. Why can't my wife have the wit to give me a child like that?" Since then he had left everything to tackle Paris. His words. What was Claquesous? He was night. He would wait till the sky had painted itself black before showing himself, crawling out from some hole after dark and crawling back into it again before daybreak. Where was this hole? Nobody knew. When it was pitch black, he would speak, though only to his accomplices and only with his back turned. Was his name really Claquesous? No. He would say, "My name is not at all." If a candle appeared, he slapped on a mask. He was a ventriloquist. Babet would say, "Claquesous is a night bird with two calls." Claquesous was blurry, restless, terrible. You couldn't be sure he had a name, Claquesous being only a nickname meaning blow your dough. You couldn't be sure he had a voice, his stomach having more to say than his mouth. You couldn't be sure he had a face, nobody having seen anything but his mask. He would vanish like an apparition and then reappear as though popping up out of the ground. A lugubrious creature that was Montparnasse. Montparnasse was a mere boy, less than 20 years old, with a pretty face, lips like cherries, lustrous black hair, the brightness of spring in his eyes. He had all the vices and aspired to all the crimes. Digesting what was bad gave him a craving for what was worse. He was the street kid turned lout, and the lout turned killer. He was cute, effeminate, graceful, wiry, lethargic, cruel. He wore his hat turned up on the left to make room for a tuft of hair in the vogue of 1829. He lived off armed robbery. His redingote was of the best cut but worn. Montparnasse was a fashion plate who had fallen on hard times, living in misery and committing murder and mayhem. The cause of all of this adolescent's assaults was the desire to look slick and expensive. The first hussy who had said to him, "You're easy on the eye," had flung the stain of darkness into his heart and turned this Abel into a Cain. Finding himself pretty, he had wanted to be elegant, and, well, the first form elegance takes is idleness, and the idleness of a pauper means crime. Few prowlers were as feared as Montparnasse. At 18 he already had several corpses to his name. More than one passer-by, with their arms outstretched and their face in a pool of blood, lay dead in the shadow of this miserable wretch. With his crimped and pomaded hair, his pinched waist, his womanly hips, and the bust of a Prussian officer, surrounded by the murmur of admiration of the girls on the boulevard, his tie suavely knotted, a club in his pocket, and a flower in his buttonhole, such was this fop of the House of Death. Composition of the troupe. Together, these four crooks formed a single entity, a sort of Proteus, snaking through and around the police and strenuously avoiding the indiscreet gaze of the great Vidocq by taking on, like the ancient Greek sea god, various guises, tree, flame, fountain, lending each other their names and tricks, disappearing into their own shadows, each one a secret bolt-hole and refuge for the others, throwing off their personalities as you take off a false nose at a masked ball, sometimes simplifying themselves to the point of being just one person, sometimes multiplying themselves to the point where Coco Lacour himself took them for a crowd. These four men were not four men. They were a sort of single, four-headed mystery thief working Paris in a big way. They were a single, monstrous polyp of evil, living in the crypt of society. Thanks to their offshoots and to the underlying network of their contacts, Babet, Gueulemer, Clarksou, and Montparnasse ran the general ambush business of the entire département of the Seine. They performed the coup d'état of the underworld on unsuspecting passers-by. Men with ideas in this line, men of nocturnal imagination, came to them to get the job done. People came to these four rogues with the outline, and they took care of the stage management. They worked up the script. They were always able to provide the right number and type of personnel for any crime that needed a hand, and were sufficiently lucrative. If a crime was short-handed, they subcontracted accomplices. They had a troop of shady extras at their disposal for any secret underworld drama. They usually gathered together at nightfall, which is when they woke up, in the wasteland next to La Salpêtrière. This is where they conferred. That way they had 12 hours of darkness ahead of them, and they worked out how to put them to use. Patron Minette was the name in circulation in the underground for this four-man society. In the old popular whimsical parlance, disappearing a little more each day, Patron Minette refers to early morning just as entre chien et loup, between dog and wolf, refers to early evening. The name Patron Minette probably derived from the time their work usually finished, dawn being the moment phantoms fade and the crooks break up. It is the name these four men were known by. When the Chief Justice of the Circuit Court visited La Sanère in jail, he questioned him over a felony that La Sanère denied committing. "Who did it, then?" the judge demanded. La Sanère gave this reply, puzzling to the magistrate but clear as day to the police. "Could be Patron Minette." Sometimes you can tell what a play is like from the list of the characters. Similarly, you can more or less appreciate a gang by the list of gangsters. There follows, for these particular names linger on in special memoirs, a list of the names the principal affiliates of Patron Minette answer to. Panchaud, alias Printanier, alias Bigrenaille, or Hotwack, Spring-like, Go Lightly. Brujon. There was a whole dynasty of Brujons. We can't promise not to say more about this later. Boulatruelle, the road mender we have already met. La Veuve, or the widow. Finistère. Omer Hugu, a black man. Mardi Soir, or Tuesday Night. Dépêche, or Dispatch. Fauntleroy, alias Bouquetière, or the flower girl, that is, prostitute. Glorieux, or Glorious, a freed convict. Barcarros, or Coachrod, alias Monsieur Dupont. L'Esplanade du Sud, or South Esplanade. Poussagrive, or Push-a-Thrush. Camagnolet. Raudeniers, alias Bizarro. Mange-Dentelle, or Eat-Lace. Le Pied en l'air, or Feet in the Air. Demilliard, alias Dumilliard, or Half a Liard, 2 billion, etc., etc. We pass over the rest, and not the worst. These names have faces. They express not only beings, but species. Each one of these names corresponds to a variety of those deformed toadstools that grow underneath civilization. These beings were by no means happy showing their faces, though. They were not among those you see getting about the streets. During the day, tuckered out by the turbulent nights they put in, they went off to sleep, sometimes in plaster kilns, sometimes in the abandoned quarries of Montmartre or Montrouge, at times even in the sewers. They went to ground. What's become of these men? They still exist. They have always existed. Horace talks about them. Ambubaiarum colligia. Pharmacopolae, mendici, mimde. And for as long as society is what it is, they will be what they are. Under the dark roof of their holds, they are forever reborn out of the slime society oozes. Like ghosts, they return always the same, only they no longer bear the same names and no longer get about in the same skins. The individuals may be eradicated, but the tribe lives on. They always have the same skills. From the truant to the prowler, the race maintains its purity. They can divine purses in pockets. They can smell watches and fobs. Gold and silver have a distinct smell for them. They are guileless bourgeois who look as though they were just born to be robbed. These men patiently follow such bourgeois. When a foreigner or a provincial goes by, they quiver like spiders. Men like that, when you run into them or merely catch a glimpse of them on a deserted boulevard around midnight, are terrifying. They don't look like men at all, but like shapes made of living mist. You'd say they were one with the darkness, that they can't be distinguished from it, that they have no soul other than the gloom, and that it is only momentarily, just to live a monstrous life for a few minutes, that they break away from the night. What is required to dissolve these ghouls? Light. Floods of light. No bat can brave the dawn. Light up the dregs of society. Book 8. The Bad Pauper. Marius looks for a girl in a hat and meets a man in a cap. Summer passed, then autumn. Winter came. Neither Monsieur Leblanc nor the young girl had set foot in the Luxembourg again. Marius now had only one thought, to see that sweet, adorable face again. He looked endlessly, he looked everywhere. He found nothing. He was no longer Marius, the keen dreamer, the man who was resolute, ardent, and strong, the reckless provocateur of fate, the brain full of schemes for the future, the fresh mind full of plans, projects, points of pride, ideas, and desires. He was a lost dog. He fell into a black well of sadness. It was all over. Work disgusted him. Walking wearied him. Solitude bored him. The whole wide world of nature, once filled with shapes, limpid revelations, voices, counsel, perspectives, horizons, teachings, was now empty in his eyes. It seemed to him that everything had evaporated. He went on thinking still, for he could hardly do otherwise, but he no longer took any pleasure in his thoughts. To everything that they suggested to him, gently but persistently, he would reply, "What's the use?" He chided himself many times over, "Why did I have to go and follow her? I was so happy just seeing her. She looked at me. Didn't that mean the world to me? She looked as though she loved me. Wasn't that everything? What more did I want? There's nothing more after that. I was a fool. It's all my fault." And so on, and so forth. Courfeyrac, to whom he confided nothing, that was his nature, but who guessed just about everything, which was his nature, started off congratulating him for being in love, though he was utterly amazed then when he saw Marius plunged into the depths of melancholy like this. He wound up confronting him. "I say you're human after all. So, come to the Chaumière." Once, lulled by the beautiful September sunshine, Marius had let himself be dragged off to the Sceaux ball by Courfeyrac, Bossuet, and Grantaire, hoping against hope, what a dream, that he might perhaps find her there. Naturally, he did not see the girl he was looking for. "But this is the place if you're looking for lost women," Grantaire growled behind his back. Marius left his friends at the ball and returned home on foot, alone, weary, feverish, his eyes sad and cloudy in the night, stunned by the racket and the dust kicked up by the riotous old rattle-traps full of carousing people that rolled past him, coming back from the party, while he, downhearted, breathed in the acrid scent of the walnut trees along the road to clear his head. He reverted to living more and more on his own again, distraught, stricken, totally ruled by his inner anguish, crashing around in his pain like a wolf in a trap, searching everywhere for the missing girl, punch-drunk with love. Another time, he had an encounter that had a powerful effect on him. In one of the little streets in the neighborhood of the Boulevard des Invalides, he had come across a man dressed like a workman and wearing a cap with a long peak from which strands of very white hair escaped. Marius was struck by the beauty of this white hair, and studied the man carefully as he trudged slowly along as though absorbed in painful meditation. The strange thing was that he thought he recognized Monsieur Leblanc. It was the same hair, the same profile, as far as you could tell, with that cap, the same pace, only sadder. But why the workman's get-up? What was that about? What did this disguise mean? Marius was truly astounded. When he snapped out of it, his first impulse was to follow the man. Who knows if he would not then at last stumble on the trail he was looking for? In any case, he needed to see the man again up close and clear up the enigma. But he hit on the idea too late. The man was already nowhere to be seen. He had taken some tiny side street, and Marius could not find him again. This encounter worried him for a few days, then faded. After all, he told himself, it's probably just a resemblance. A find. Marius had not stopped living at the Gorbeau slum. He paid no attention to anyone there. At the time, it is true, there were no other residents in the slum apart from himself and the Jondrettes, whose rent he had once paid without ever having actually spoken either to the father or the mother or the daughters. The other tenants had either moved or died, or had been evicted for not paying the rent. One day that winter the sun had shown itself a little in the afternoon, but it was February 2nd, that ancient feast of Candlemas, whose treacherous sun, harbinger of 6 weeks of cold, inspired in Mathieu Lansbert these two lines that have rightly become classic. Whether it gleams or it glimmers, the bear goes back to its lair. Marius had just emerged from his. Night was coming down. It was time for dinner, for he was forced to eat once more, alas. Oh, the weakness of ideal passions! He had just stepped outside his door, where Ma Bougon was at that moment sweeping the doorstep while delivering this memorable monologue.
What's cheap these days? Everything's dear. The only thing that's cheap is the world's troubles. They come for nothing. The world's troubles.
Marius ambled slowly up the boulevard toward the Barrière, on the way to the Rue Saint-Jacques. He was thinking as he walked, his head down. All of a sudden he felt himself elbowed in the gathering gloom. He wheeled round and saw two young girls in rags, one tall and thin, the other a bit shorter, running past, fast, out of breath, scared. They looked as though they were running from something. They'd been heading his way, had not seen him, and had run into him in passing. In the twilight, Marius could just make out their livid faces, their thin, matted hair, their awful bonnets, their tattered skirts and bare feet. They were talking to each other as they ran. The taller one said, in a very low voice, "The cops came. They nearly nabbed me." The other one replied, "I saw. Did I make a run for it?" Marius understood by this sinister slang that the two girls had just missed being apprehended by gendarmes or police officers and that they had escaped. They dived under the trees in the boulevard behind him and were a dim white smudge in the darkness for a few seconds before vanishing altogether. Marius had stopped for a moment, but just as he was about to continue on his way, he saw a small grayish packet on the ground at his feet. He bent down and picked it up. It was a sort of envelope that felt like it contained papers. "Right," he said to himself, "those poor girls must have dropped this." He turned back after them and called out, but he knew he'd never find them now. He reckoned they were already a fair way off, and so he put the packet in his pocket and went to dinner. On his way he saw in an alley off the Rue Mouffetard a child's coffin covered in a black cloth, placed on three chairs and lit by a candle. The two girls, in the gloaming, came back to him. "Poor mothers," he thought. "There's only one thing sadder than seeing your children die, and that's seeing them go bad." Then these shadows that shifted his sadness for a moment vanished from his mind, and he lapsed into his usual woes. He set to thinking once more of his 6 months of love and happiness out in the open air, under the beautiful trees of the Luxembourg, in the sun.
"How gloomy my life has become," he said to himself. "Young girls still appear to me. Only once upon a time they were angels. Now they are ghouls."
Quadrifrons. That evening, as he was undressing for bed, he felt in his coat pocket and came across the packet he had picked up on the boulevard. He'd forgotten all about it. He thought it might be useful to open it, for it might well contain the girl's address, if in fact it belonged to them, or at least the information necessary to restore it to whoever had lost it. He opened the envelope, which was not sealed. It contained 4 letters, all addressed but also not sealed. All 4 reeked of cheap tobacco. The first letter was addressed to Madame la Marquise de Groucheret, square opposite the Chamber of Deputies, number blank. Marius told himself that he would probably find the clues he was looking for inside, and that, in any case, the letter was not sealed, so it was likely that it could be read without impropriety. This is how it went. "Madame la Marquise, the virtue of clemency and piety is what most tightly binds society. Give your Christian feeling an airing, and look with compassion upon this unfortunate Spaniard, victim of loyalty and attachment to the sacred cause of legitimacy, which he has paid for with his blood, to which he has consecrated his fortune, wholly to defend this cause, and today finds himself in the greatest misery. He has no doubt that your honorable person will grant him succor to preserve an existence extremely painful for a military man of education and honor, riddled with wounds. Count in advance on the humanity that move you and on the interest that Madame la Marquise bears such an unhappy nation. Their prayer will not be in vain, and their gratitude will preserve her charming memory. Of my respectful sentiments, which I have the honor to be, Madame, Don Alvarez, Spanish captain of cavalry, royalist refugee in France that finds himself on a voyage for his homeland and lack in funds to continue his voyage." No address followed the signature. Marius hoped to find the address in the second letter, whose formal address was set out as "To Madame la Comtesse de Montvernet, Rue Cassette, No. 9. This is what Marius read in this one. "Madame la Comtesse, this is an unfortunate mother of a family of 6 children, the last one being only 8 months old. I'm sick since my last lie-in, abandoned by my husband for 5 months, not having any resource in the world, in the most awful indigence. In the hope of Madame la Comtesse, she has the honor to be, Madame, with deep respect, wife Balizard." Marius went on to the third letter, which was a begging letter like the preceding. It read, "Monsieur Papelgeot, Elector, Hosiery Wholesaler, Rue Saint-Denis, at the corner of the Rue Offert. I take the liberty of addressing this letter to you to beg you to grant me the precious favour of your sympathies, and to interest you in a man of letters who has just sent a play to the Théâtre Français. The subject of it is historic, and the action happens in Auvergne in the days of the Empire. The style, I think, is natural in it, pithy, and may have some merit. There are verses to sing in 4 places. The comic, the serious, the unpredictable, blend in it with the variety of the characters and with a tinge of romanticism lightly spread all through the plot, which works mysteriously and goes, by striking twists and turns, to come to a head amid several wonderful stage coups. My main aim is to satisfy the desire that is progressively driving the man of our century, that is to say, the fashion, that capricious and bizarre weather vane that changes at each new wind, almost. Despite these qualities, I have grounds to fear that jealousy and the selfishness of privileged authors obtain my exclusion from the theatre, for I am well aware of the difficulties newcomers are bombarded with. Monsieur Papourgeot, your just reputation as enlightened patron of literary folks emboldens me to send you my daughter, who will reveal our indigent situation, lacking bread and fire in this winter season,
to tell you that I beg you to accept the homage I desire to make you of my play and all those that I will do, is to prove to you how ambitious I am of the honor of sheltering under your aegis and of adorning my writings with your name. If you deign to honor me with the most modest offering, I'll get busy straight away and do a piece in verse to pay you my tribute of gratitude. This piece that I will try and make as perfect as possible will be sent to you before being inserted at the beginning of the play and reeled off on stage. To Monsieur and Madame Pabourgeot, my most respectful homages, Jean Flo, Man of Letters. P.S. If only 40 sous. Pardon me for sending my daughter and for not presenting myself, but sad grounds of dress do not permit me, alas, to go out. Finally, Marius opened the fourth letter. The address ran, To the Benevolent Gentleman of the Church of Saint-Jacques-du-Haut-Pas. It contained these few lines. Benevolent man, if you deign to accompany my daughter, you will see a miserable calamity, and I will show you my certificates. At the sight of these writings, your generous soul will be moved by a feeling of marked benevolence, for true philosophers always experience lively emotions. Agree, compassionate man, that you have to experience the cruelest want, and that it is truly painful to obtain some relief, to have it attested by the authorities as if we weren't free to suffer and to die of starvation, waiting for someone to relieve our misery. The fates are truly fatal for some and too profligate or too protective for others. I await your presence or your offering, if you deign make one, and I beg you to accept the respectful feelings with which I honour myself to be truly magnanimous man, your very humble and very obedient servant, P. Fabantou, dramatic artiste. After reading these letters, Marius did not find himself any the wiser. First, none of the signatories gave their address. Then, they seemed to come from four different individuals. Don Alvarez, wife Balizar, the poet Jean Flo, and the dramatic artiste Fabantou, but the letters had one strange feature in common, and that was that they were all four written in the same handwriting. What could you conclude from that except that they came from the same person? On top of that, and this made the conjecture even more convincing, the paper, which was coarse and yellowed, was the same for all four. The smell of tobacco was the same, and even though efforts had been made to vary the style, the same spelling mistakes recurred with profound complacency, Jean Flo, the man of letters, being no more exempt than the Spanish captain. There was no point trying to unravel this little mystery. If he hadn't found the bundle of letters by accident, it would have looked like a hoax. Marius was too sad even to laugh at a random joke or join in some game the streets of Paris apparently wanted to play with him. He felt like the blind man in a game of blind man's buff with the four letters poking fun at him. Besides, nothing indicated that the letters belonged to the girls Marius had run into on the boulevard. After all, they were obviously worthless bits of paper. Marius shoved them back in the envelope, threw the bundle into a corner, and went to bed. At around 7 o'clock the next morning, he had just gotten up and had breakfast and was trying to get down to work when someone knocked gently on his door. As he owned nothing, he never took his key out of the door except sometimes, very rarely, when he was working on some urgent job, and anyway, even when he wasn't there, he left the key in the door. "You'll get yourself robbed," Mabougon used to say. "What of?" Marius would reply. The fact is that one day someone did take an old pair of boots, to Mabougon's great triumph. There was a second knock, as gentle as the first. "Come in," said Marius. The door opened. "What do you want, Mabougon?" Marius said, without taking his eyes off the books and manuscripts on his table. A voice, which was not that of Mabougon, answered.
"Pardon me, monsieur."
It was a dull, broken, strangled, rasping voice, the rough voice of an old man made husky by brandy and spirits. Marius turned round and saw a young girl. A Rose in Misery. A very young girl was standing in the half-open doorway. The garret's dormer window, where daylight now appeared, was directly opposite the door, and lit up this figure with a wan light. She was a haggard, sickly, emaciated creature, with nothing but a chemise and a skirt over shivering, freezing nakedness. A bit of string for a belt, a bit of string for a hairband, bony shoulders poking up out of the chemise, a blonde, lymphatic pallor, collarbones covered in dirt, red hands, a slack and depraved mouth, missing teeth, dull, defiant, mean eyes, in which a corrupt old woman looked out of the body of an aborted young girl. 50 years were packed into 15, in one of those beings that are both weak and repulsive together, and that make you shudder when they don't make you weep. Malyus had stood and was studying her in a sort of stupor, this being so very like the shadows that flit through our dreams. What was especially harrowing was that the girl had not come into the world to be ugly. In early infancy she must even have been pretty. The grace of a child was still struggling with the ghastly, premature aging brought on by debauchery and poverty. A trace of lingering beauty was dying in this 16-year-old face like pale sunlight smothered by grim clouds at dawn on a winter's day. The face was not absolutely unfamiliar to Malyus. He thought he remembered seeing it somewhere. "What do you want, mademoiselle?" he asked. The young girl answered in her drunken galley-slave's voice,
"There's a letter for you, Monsieur Marius."
She called Marius by his name. He could not doubt that her business was with him, but who was this girl? How did she know his name? Without waiting for an invitation, she sauntered in, giving the room and the unmade bed the once-over with an assurance that made your heart sink. Her feet were bare. Big rips in her skirt gave a glimpse of her long, skinny legs and her bony knees. She was shivering. She did, in fact, have a letter in her hand, and she handed it to Marius. Marius opened the letter and noticed that the enormous blob of sealing wax was still wet. The message could not have come far. He read, "My very kind neighbor, young man, I have learned of your good deeds on my behalf that you paid my rent 6 months ago. I bless you, young man. My elder daughter will tell you that we have been without a scrap of bread for 2 days, 4 persons and my Mrs. Crook. If I'm not deceived in my thinking, I believe I can hope that your generous heart will melt at this report and you will be overcome with the desire to smile upon me by deigning to bestow a small kindness upon me. I am, with the distinguished consideration that we owe the benefactors of humanity, Jondrette. P.S. My daughter will await your orders, dear Monsieur Marius." This letter, cropping up in the middle of the obscure episode that had been worrying Marius since the night before, was a candle in a cave. Everything was suddenly clear as day. This letter had come from the same place as the other four. It was the same writing, the same style, same spelling, same paper, same reek of tobacco. There were 5 missives, 5 tales, 5 names, 5 signatures, and a single signatory. The Spanish captain, Don Alvarez, the unhappy Balizar, the dramatic poet Jean Flo, the aging actor Fabantou, were all 4 named Jondrette, if indeed Jondrette's name really was Jondrette. As we might have mentioned, in all the fairly long time that Marius had lived in the building so far, he had only rarely had occasion to see, or even glimpse, what neighbors there were. His mind was elsewhere, and where your mind is, your eyes follow. He must have crossed paths with the Jondrettes in the hallway or on the stairs, but for him, they were mere silhouettes. He had taken so little notice of them that the night before, he had knocked into the Jondrette girls on the boulevard without recognizing them. For it was obviously them. But even now, when this one had come into his room, it was only with great difficulty that he vaguely recalled, through the pity and disgust she aroused in him, having run into her somewhere else. Now he saw it all clearly. He understood that the business his neighbor Jondrette was in his distress, was to exploit the charitable, that he procured the addresses of people he had sized up as rich and compassionate, and wrote them under assumed names letters that the girls delivered by hand, at their peril, for this father had sunk so low as to put his own daughters at risk. He was playing a game with fate, and they were the pawns. Marius understood that probably, judging by their flight the night before, their breathlessness, their terror, and the words of slang that he had heard, these sorry girls were also practicing all sorts of dark trades, and that the net result of the whole sordid business was two miserable beings who were neither children nor girls nor women, monsters of a sort at once foul and innocent, produced by dire poverty, smack in the middle of human society as we know it. Sad creatures, without name, without age, without sex, already beyond good and evil, emerging from childhood into the world, already stripped of everything, with neither liberty, nor virtue, nor any responsibility left. Souls blossoming only yesterday, but today faded like flowers fallen in the street, spattered by mud from all directions, before being crushed under a wheel. Yet while Marius pinned her with a stunned and sorrowful look, the young girl was pacing up and down the garret as though she owned the place, with the audacity of a revenant. She thrashed about, completely oblivious to her nakedness. At times, her unbuttoned and torn chemise nearly fell down to her waist. She moved the chairs around. She rearranged the toiletries on the chest of drawers. She felt Marius's clothes. She fumbled through the pockets.
"Well, well," she said, "you have a mirror."
And quite as if she were alone, she hummed snatches of vaudeville tunes, playful refrains that her raucous, guttural voice turned sinister. Beneath the daring, something forced, anxious, and abashed broke through. Effrontery is a form of shame. Nothing could be more mournful than to see her frolicking and flitting, so to speak, about the room, like a bird with a broken wing, frightened by daylight. You felt that in different circumstances, with an education and a different life, the girl's carefree, chirpy manner might have been sweet and charming. Never in the animal kingdom does a creature born to be a dove turn into a rapacious, white-tailed eagle. This only happens among men. Marius was thinking his thoughts and let her carry on. She went to the table.
"Ah," she said, "books."
A light flashed in her glassy eyes. As she went on, her tone expressed the joy of being able to boast about something no human being is immune to.
"I can read, you know."
She swiftly grabbed the book that lay open on the table and read fairly fluently.
"General Bauduin received the order to take the 5 battalions of his brigade and capture the Chateau of Hougoumont, which is in the middle of the plain of Waterloo."
She broke off.
"Ah, Waterloo. I know about that. It was a battle long ago. My father was there. My father served in the army. We are Bonapartist, as all get out at home, you know. It was against the English, Waterloo."
She put the book back down, took a pen, and cried,
"And I can write, too."
She dipped the pen in the ink and turned to Marius.
"Do you want to see? Look, I'll write something to show you."
And before he had time to answer, she wrote on a blank sheet of paper that was lying on the table,
"The cops are here."
Then she tossed the pen aside.
"There are no spelling mistakes. You can see for yourself. We've had education, my sister and me. We haven't always been what we are. We weren't made to—"
Here she stopped, fixed her lackluster eye on Malthus, and burst out laughing, before saying, in a tone that contained extreme anguish smothered by extreme cynicism,
"Gah!"
And she began to croon these words to a very merry tune. "I'm hungry, father. No stew. I'm cold, mother. No woolies. Shiver, Lalotte.
Sob, Jacot."
She had barely finished this verse when she cried,
Do you sometimes go to shows, Monsieur Marius? I do. I've got a little brother who's friends with the artists, and he sometimes gives me tickets. For one thing, I don't like balcony seats. You don't have any room, and it's uncomfortable. There's sometimes real riffraff there, and there's also a lot of smelly people.
She studied Marius, then adopted an odd look and said,
"You know, Monsieur Marius, you are a very good-looking boy."
The same thought struck them both at the same time, which made her smile and made him blush. She walked over to him and placed a hand on his shoulder.
"You never notice me, but I know you, Monsieur Marius. I run into you here on the stairs, and then I see you visiting a man named Father Mabeuf, who lives over Austerlitz way sometimes when I'm out walking around there. It suits you, you know, your hair sticking up like that."
Her voice struggled to sound soft and sweet, but only managed to go very low. Some of her words were lost in the journey from larynx to lips, as on a keyboard that is missing some notes. Marius had quietly backed away. "Mademoiselle," he said with cold gravity, "I have here a packet that is, I believe, yours. Allow me to give it back to you." And he held out to her the envelope containing the four letters. She clapped her hands together and cried,
"We looked everywhere!"
Then she swiftly grabbed the packet and opened the envelope, prattling away as she did so.
"God in heaven, we looked high and low, did we ever, my sister and me, and you found them. On the boulevard, I bet. It must have been on the boulevard. You see, they fell when we were running. It's my brat of a sister who slipped like an idiot. When we got home, we couldn't find them anywhere, since we didn't want to get the strap. There's no point, I mean, what for? Whatever for, we'd told them at home that we'd taken the letters to the people, and they'd told us nothing doing. And here they are, the poor old letters. How could you tell they were mine? But, of course, the writing. So it was you we bumped into last night when we were going past. We couldn't see, naturally. I said to my sister, 'Was that some sort of gent?' My sister said, 'I reckon.'"
She had by now unfolded the begging letter addressed to the malevolent gentleman of the church of Saint-Jacques-du-Haut-Pas.
"Look," she said, "this one's for the old geezer who goes to mass. Actually, it's on right now. I think I'll take it to him. Maybe he'll give us something so we can have breakfast."
Then she started laughing again and added,
"You know what it'll mean if we have breakfast today? It'll mean we'll have had our breakfast for the day before yesterday, our dinner for the day before yesterday, our breakfast for yesterday, our dinner for yesterday, all in the one meal this morning. Well, so what? Like it or lump it, or drop dead, dogs."
This reminded Marius of what the poor sorry creature had come to his room for. He fumbled in his jacket and found nothing. The young girl went on, regardless, talking as though she were no longer conscious of Marius's being there.
"Sometimes I take off at night. Sometimes I don't come back. Before we were here last winter, we lived under the arches of bridges. We huddled together so as not to freeze. My little sister cried, 'Water! God, it's sad!' I thought of drowning myself, but then I thought, 'No, it's too cold.' I go off on my own when I feel like it. Sometimes I sleep in a ditch. You know, at night when I'm walking on the boulevard, I see trees like forks. I see houses all black and as big as the towers of Notre Dame. I pretend that the white walls are the river, and I say to myself, 'Look, there's water here.' The stars are like little paper lanterns, all lit up. You'd say they were smoking, and that the wind then snuffs them out. It gives me the shivers, as if I had horses breathing in my ear all of a sudden. Even though it's night, I can hear Barbary organs, and the machines in the mills spinning. I don't know. I feel like they're people, and they're throwing stones at me. I run for it. I don't even know I'm doing it. Everything's spinning. It's all a whirl. When you haven't eaten, you feel funny."
And she stared at him, wild-eyed. After digging deep into his pockets, Marius finally got 5 francs, 16 sous together. It was at that moment all he had in the world. "This will do for my dinner today," he thought. "Tomorrow we'll see." He kept the 16 sous and gave the 5 francs to the girl. She ripped it out of his hand.
"Hooray," she said, "the sun's out."
And as if this sun had the property of causing avalanches of slang to melt in her brain, she went on. A fiver, a shiner, a monarch. In this joint, I'll be blowed. Knock me down with a feather. You beauty, you're not a bad sort. Hats off, never say die. 2 days of pine cones. Muck for meat and slosh for grub. We'll stuff our faces. Don't think we won't. She hitched her chemise back onto her shoulders, gave Marius a deep bow, then a cheeky wave of the hand, and tripped to the door.
I'm on my way, monsieur. Hell's bells, I'm off to find the old man.
As she passed, she spotted a crust of dry bread gathering mold in the dust on top of the chest of drawers, and she fell upon it and bit into it, muttering,
Good, nice and hard. I can cut my teeth on it.
And with that, she left. The Judas of Providence. For 5 years, Marius had lived in poverty, in deprivation, even in distress. But he realized he had never known real misery. Real misery he had just seen. It was the specter that had just passed before his very eyes. Actually, anyone who has seen the misery of men only has seen nothing. You have to see the misery of women. Anyone who has seen the misery of women only has seen nothing. You have to see the misery of a child. When a man has hit rock bottom, and death is not far off, he comes to the end of his tether, his wits end at the same time. Woe to the defenseless beings around him. Work, wages, bread, heat, courage, goodwill, he lacks everything at once. The light of day seems to go out without. The moral light goes out within. In these dark shadows, men come up against the weakness of women and children and bend them brutally to ignominious ends. Then all horrors may break loose. Despair is penned in by the flimsiest walls, all of them opening onto vice or crime. Health, youth, honor, the sacred and fierce fragility of still fresh young flesh. The heart, virginity, modesty. That skin of the soul are sinisterly twisted and misused by this groping in the dark after resources, which comes up against infamy and accommodates it. Fathers, mothers, children, brothers, sisters, men, women, girls cling together and form a mass almost like some mineral outcrop in this murky promiscuity of sexes, relationships, ages, foul deeds, innocent acts. They squat down on their haunches, back to back, in a kind of slum destiny, eyeing each other miserably. Oh, the poor unfortunates. Look how pale they are. See how cold they are. They seem to be on a planet a lot farther away from the sun than we are. This young girl was for Marius a sort of emissary from the darkest depths. She revealed to him a whole dreadful side of the night. Marius almost reproached himself for being so absorbed in the daydreams and passion that had kept him from casting so much as a glance at his neighbors until that day. To have cobbled together their rent was a mechanical gesture. Anyone would have done the same thing. But he, Marius, should have done more. For God's sake, a mere wall separated him from these abandoned beings that lived groping around in the dark, beyond the land of the living. He rubbed shoulders with them. He was, in a way, the last link in the chain of the human race that they touched. He could hear them living, or rather groaning in agony, right next to him, and he had taken no notice. Every day, at every moment, through the wall, he could hear them walking, coming and going, talking, and he hadn't even listened. And among those words, there were moans, and he hadn't even registered. His thoughts were elsewhere, lost in dreams, in wild fantasies, in love in the open air, in giddy delusions, and yet these human beings, his brothers in Jesus Christ, his brothers in the common people, were dying in agony right next to him. Dying pointlessly. He even contributed to their misfortune, and he exacerbated it. For if they had had a different neighbor, a less fanciful and more attentive neighbor, a normal, charitable man, obviously their destitution would not have gone unnoticed. Their distress signals would have been seen, and for a long time already, perhaps, they would have been rescued and saved. Of course, they seemed utterly depraved, utterly corrupt, utterly vile, utterly odious even. But they are rare, those who have fallen without being damaged on the way down.